Hello and welcome to another episode of that
Movies Mayhem and Murder. Is that right? Is it Movie Murder and Mayhem?
Movies Murder and Mayhem.
Oh, god damn it.
The one time I let you do that. Never again, Ruby Noir. Never again.
Banned from all future intros.
You could try it again.
Okay. Movies Murder and Mayhem.
The true crime, the true horror, and the true stories behind some of our favourite horror films and some of our not-so-favourite horror films, I guess.
Yeah, indeed.
So that is Ruby Noir.
Yes, indeed I am. And that is a grain.
Just one name. Just one name, like Prince, before he became.
I'm always slightly afraid that I'm going to mispronounce your last name. So you're like you're a one-name diva.
That's fine. I can live with that. Like Cher.
Exactly. Cher and Madonna and Kylie et al.
That's fine. How are you this month?
This month, I'm not going to lie, it's been a little bit shaky. I was telling you all about it off air. But it's getting better and we'll take that, won't we?
We will. We'll take that and we'll try to be positive while telling you terrible, terrible stories.
So I think this is a grain's fault because she changed her mind on what she was going to do. And I'd already told her I was doing a bummer. And she was like, oh no, I also picked a bummer. So it's going to be a double bummer episode. So saws to all you out there who were listening to this true crime podcast looking for a laugh riot.
You know, because I had said previously I was going to do the Warrens, but then it was too big for me for this month. This month has been very busy and it was just too big. I looked at my research or, you know, the pages that I was going to look at and I was like, you know what? I can't do this. I have to do a simple one.
You have to do a simple one. That's okay, yeah. Though. But yeah, so I suppose if you're looking for a laugh, possibly not the best podcast to be at. Go to the podcast next door. They're probably funnier than us.
They're probably hilarious.
And if we are funny, it's in a very inappropriate manner.
Yeah. Because that's how we deal with these things.
That's how we roll. Yeah.
Okay, so I think it is your turn to go first this month.
It is my turn to go first this month. So the movie that I decided to research the true story behind was a movie called Compliance, which I saw a while back, and it's one of these ones that has massive letters based on true events at the beginning of it. And it's not really a horror movie. It's more of a, it's not even really a thriller. It's a very, very disturbing drama, but it is kind of horrific. And I thought it's a fascinating story. No one dies, but other terrible things happen. So I suppose this is a potential trigger warning for particularly around sexual assaults. So if you're not up for that, get the hell out of here. Take care of yourself. But from 1990, are you familiar with this case at all? Or the movie?
I am, yes. Not so much the movie, the case, because it was on My Favourite Murder at a time when I was sitting in the airport waiting for a delayed plane, and it really depressed me. So, yay.
Sorry. Yeah, so for about 10 years, from 1994 to 2004, some dude basically would, they're described in certain articles as prank calls, which I think makes them seem kind of fun and impish. And there was nothing fun about any of this. So his shtick was he would call up generally fast food joints. So they could have been Wendy's, they were McDonald's, I think was a favorite, but Burger King's, Chick-fil-A's, whatever, like various different Hooters once, various different fast food joints around the country. So this was not like local to anything, to where he was. He, like, they could be on the other side of the country at this point. He would call them up. He would claim to be usually a police officer, but sometimes another authority figure, like a manager, like a general manager, a CEO, or like, you know, corporate from the company. And say that an employee, almost exclusively a young woman, but sometimes not, but usually young women, kind of late teens, early 20s, in a very vulnerable age, he would say that they had been accused of stealing from a customer and ask the managers in the restaurants to detain them, strip search them, and sometimes perform lewd acts on them. And the crazy thing was that it was done really often. To like loads of times. Like, this was not one case of someone who was particularly you know, susceptible to authority figures or anything like that. This happened continuously over the course of 10 years, which was insane to me. The worst case of it, and the one that sort of, I suppose it got the guy caught. I mean, I say caught, unfortunately, he was never convicted of any crimes, but all of these calls stopped after he was arrested and they never started happening again, was the Mount Washington incident. This was a McDonald's in Mount Washington, Kentucky. So a guy who was claimed, his name was Officer Scott, called, and I'm sorry to inject any levity into this story because it doesn't deserve it, but the assistant manager was called Donna Summers. And it's just in my head, when I'm imagining this, the movie Compliance, Anne Dowd stars plays the assistant manager. But in my head, it is just Donna Summer.
Yeah.
And that's not good, but it is very funny.
That flashed across my mind as well. What a name.
But Donna Summers, God love her. I think she has a lot of culpability in this case, I do feel sorry for her as well. But anyway. So the guy, Officer Scott, he gave a very vague description of like a young, slim woman who worked there, had been accused of stealing money out of some customer's purse. So she was like, oh, hey, Louise. And he was like, yes, definitely Louise. You know, it's like, it's this thing of like, it's cold reading at a very, not even a particularly sophisticated level. So anyway, this poor young woman, Louise, who was 18 at the time, she was taken into a back office. She was, her person was searched. She was strip searched. They took her clothes and her purse and all her personal belongings, put them in a paper bag and put them in the car so she couldn't get at them. Now, this is all stuff that the caller told them to do. So apparently what he would do is he would kind of almost groom the managers to feel like authority figures, or even like greater authority figures in and of themselves, so they would eventually just do whatever he said. The reason that the Mount Washington incident was the most serious is because there was a number of people involved. So there was the assistant manager and the other assistant manager who was witness to the first strip search, during which there was no, and obviously awful, humiliating, should not have happened, but at least no physical abuse of any kind. One of her colleagues, a guy, was asked to watch her because the caller insisted that for security reasons, a man needed to watch her while she was just sitting there naked. She had an apron on, but that's it. And he was like, oh, we're going to come down and get her and like get the stuff, and you know, but you need to watch her, and like it needs to be a guy for security reasons. So the first guy was one of her colleagues. He refused. So the Officer Scott tried to get him to do a more invasive strip search, like a cavity search, and he refused. Good for him. Bad for him. He just walked out and didn't take any further action. He just walked out, said, I'm not doing it, and went back to work. Now, I don't know how so I rewatched the movie today. It's really good. It is a very, very good movie. But again, like if it's not something that you're able for mentally, then don't go near it, because it's not particularly subtle about any of the stuff. It's not... It covers it all face on, but I don't know how much of that is true to life. It seems fairly close from the surface description, but the way that they kind of portray it is that the manager didn't realize the kinds of things that the caller was asking the men to do. So when she would talk to him, he'd be like, yeah, no, we're on our way. We just need them to watch her. Like, we just want to need to make sure. And then when the phone was passed back to these guys, he would be like, hey, what are her nipples look like? You know, so there was obviously two, but she wasn't, obviously she was like, she didn't cop on to any of this stuff, which I think, well, one would hope anyone would have, but clearly they don't. So anyway, so this guy said, no, I'm not doing that shit. He walked off. So the manager, Donna, got her fiance to come in. He was not an employee of McDonald's. He had nothing to do with it. He came in and he watched her, and the caller convinced him to spank her, to perform a cavity search on her, and to get her to perform oral sex on him.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was real bad.
Oh my God, like, how? Like,
But I mean, the worst part about it is, right, is that he knew something was up because he left. He called his friend and he said, the quote that is, I've done something really bad. So he knew. He was complicit in it. And I wonder, did in some of the earlier situations, did, because they got, like, some of the earlier ones did get real bad, like up to the point of things like cavity searches. You know, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's sexual assault as much as anything else. But I wonder, did, like, at the point where people were, where the caller was demanding things like acts of, like, sex acts, did people go, well, hang on a second? But this guy was just, he was in the situation and went, well, I guess so.
Yeah, it just seems so strange that, like, surely I'd hope that if someone was saying they're the police and they're asking you to do these things, you're like, even if it is the police, like, that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's impossible to know as well how many people got those calls and went, go fuck yourself, you're not the cop, and just hung up. And it left their brains and never, you know, like, these are just the ones where he managed to convince someone and someone was like, okay, yeah, definitely. I believe you. I believe the police. I trust the police. They're probably all white people. So anyway, the fiance left because he, I think, very quickly had crime regret. And then, so the guy that she got in next to watch her was, like, the local maintenance guy. He'd come back to, like, get some food for the evening. And he was the first person, like, everyone else had expressed, like, concerns or maybe, like, this is weird, right? It's weird. But he was the first person to be like, no, this is very, very bad. And it was only at that point, and this is after 3.5 hours, did Donna call. So the caller, Officer Scott, kept saying that he was on the other line with the regional manager of McDonald's. And he's like, oh yeah, like, I've got what's his name on the other line. He says, yeah, definitely. Or she, actually, but doesn't matter. Like, you know, she, it's all above board. So that kind of helps back up his thing. It was only at this point when someone actually told her, hang on, this guy on the other end is asking me to sexually assault this girl, did she call up the regional manager. And the regional manager was like, no, I've been asleep for the last 5 hours. I haven't talked to anyone. And then the caller hung up.
Like, it just scares me that people think that the police have that much power over, but you know, like, yeah, I don't know.
They do have that much power. And that was the thing, as Louise kind of was on record as saying that, like, because people were like, why didn't you just refuse to take your clothes off? And I was like, I had my manager standing over me telling me to do it. And I had a guy on the phone saying he was a cop, saying that either I was going to lose my job or go to jail or both. So at the time, it seemed easier to just go, sure, I'll fucking take my clothes off. Who cares? I'll just get it over with. And then at least I don't have to worry about it. So I think there's some of that as well. It's like, oh, the path of least resistance. But yeah, like, it's pretty, like, 3.5 hours of this poor fucking girl going through this. And it took that long for someone to be like, maybe we should check in with head office. Like, just a thought.
When did this happen?
This was in 2004. So this was
the last. Oh my God. Like, if you'd have said, like, the 70s, I'd have been like, maybe. No,
all of these instances took place between 1994 and 2004.
Like, no, I just, no, I can't get into that mindset of, like, even if it was the actual police on the phone, like, why would the police call? They'd be down, exactly, they'd be, yeah, down, they'd be down in the place, in McDonald's.
There's a very small, like, you know, it doesn't stand up to a huge amount of scrutiny. But, like, I suppose, like, I don't want to defend anyone in this case, particularly not that guy. Like, he absolutely just took advantage of the situation. But I can see if you're tired and you're, like, you're overworked, you're tired, you're, like, you're working in a fucking fast food restaurant, you don't have a lot of money, God knows what else is going on in your outside life, and you get a call and you're just like, oh yeah, fuck it, whatever. Like, I can kind of see, like, we're all susceptible to that thing in some ways. It's just, for some people, it's probably the police. For other people, it's other things. You know, they always talk about, you know, people always say, oh, I'd never fall for a cult, I'd never fall for an MLM. But, like, everyone will under the right circumstances. And I think it's that. I think he managed to get people at like the right time under the right circumstances, that it was just, it was, they were primed to believe him for whatever reason. Also, I think there is an element of people in relatively low paid jobs, but in managerial positions, having a little power trip. Because apparently one of the tricks that he used to like prime these people to do this stuff for them was like, you know, you're great at this. Like, oh God, you're practically a cop yourself, you know? That kind of stuff. So it's like committing these acts of humiliation and power over these people that they have control over was giving them a little bit of a kick. Like they were getting this, they were getting affirmation from an authority figure that they were doing the right thing.
Yeah. And it just freaks me out, because even though this guy wasn't a cop, there are still cops out there that will use their position of power to do things like we've seen in the Metropolitan Police and in our own police force, of like how many instances of sexual abuse has happened because that's what freaks me out, that, you know, it's like, oh, he wasn't a real policeman. You're like, well, he could have been.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like the fact that, the fact that people, like someone people thought was a policeman, asked them to do these things and they were like, yep, seems legit. Like, just awful. So her ordeal came to an end after 3.5 hours, which is just a horrendous amount of time for that to have been endured. They found the guy. So one of the other employees at McDonald's was smart enough to do, for the kids out there, you won't remember this, but *69 used to be what you do on your landline phone to get the number that just called you, but it only worked before another call came in. So they managed to do it before another call came in. And so they managed to trace it, and he had used a burner phone, he had bought phone cards, all this kind of stuff, but they did manage to trace it back to this guy who was a corrections officer in Florida, I think.
Oh my God.
So yeah, but apparently he had a lot of like fake cop outfits and like stuff in his house. So I think this was a bit of a, like, he really wanted to be a cop. And this is, I don't know. Unfortunately, the real bummer of this story, well, sorry, not the real bummer, but one of the real bummers of this story, is that he was acquitted of all charges. The jury felt they did not have enough evidence to convict him. Yeah. So, he was extradited to Kentucky to be, and was tried on charges of impersonating a police officer and solicitation of sodomy, which is probably a technicality, but... And he faced up to 15 years in prison, but he was acquitted of all charges in 2006. But he's remained a suspect in pretty much all similar cases, and the scam calls stopped after he was arrested. So I think there's kind of no doubt that it was him.
Mm-hmm.
Both Donna and Louise sued McDonald's for various different amounts for not protecting them. Because these calls had been going on for so long, they felt that the company had not sufficiently warned them about these calls, that there wasn't enough protections in place. Louise was awarded $5 million by a court. She ended up settling for a lesser amount because obviously McDonald's were going to appeal into eternity. So I think she settled for $1.1 million. And Donna also got an amount. She was awarded an amount as well. She entered an Alford plea, which is in the States, it's a plea where it's like, it's a guilty plea, but under the understanding that the person still maintains that they're innocent. The whole thing, this particular incident, the whole thing was caught on tape, on surveillance. So there was kind of no question as to who did what and where and when. Her fiance was, he pleaded guilty to all counts of kind of sexual assault and stuff. I think he knew exactly what he'd done. And I feel like saying to his credit, actually like admitted to it, because that's such a low bar, but it is the lowest of all bars to do. But, you know, we live in a society where so many men are like, oh, so I guess a tiny amount of credit where a tiny amount of credit is due. He served 5 years. So someone at least was held accountable for their actions to a point. Yeah, obviously it, like, all the women who this has affected were horribly traumatized, and God knows how it affected them across the years. But it's a bummer of a case, but it's also really fascinating. I say that in kind of a very academic kind of sterile manner. Like, it is interesting, like, how easily people were manipulated, how willing they were to go along with this figure of authority that was just the voice on the other end of the phone. Like, what do you think about the manager, about Donna Summers?
I don't know, because, like you said, it's very easy to kind of get into this lemming mentality of, okay, there's a voice of authority and I have to do as I'm told, and they groomed her or whatever. But at what point do you go, no, like, this isn't... I'm thinking about even, you know, it was the early 2000s, so we had, you know, television that showed you kind of pretty much exactly what police do, and at what point do you go, hang on, that's not what police do?
Yeah,
like, you might not have had a lot of interaction with them, but you know. And I just feel like if I was in the same position, I'd be like, no, like, that's not how this works. I have nothing to do with the law, but I know that you can't be on the phone being like, in the first place, how would they know?
Yeah.
Like, how would they know that someone's been stealing?
They say that, you know, the things were like, there was like, I don't know, I am taking some of this from the film, so I don't know how much of this is true to what was said. But, you know, it's like the customer had gone to the police and said, oh, someone like nicked some money out of my purse, and it was this girl at this thing, but, you know, but we're too busy to deal with such a minor matter, so we're basically deputizing you as manager to sort it out for us. Like, obviously that's paraphrasing, but that was kind of it. And then there was, like, in the film, this, like, and I felt it created this, like, my animal brain just started shivering in fear, because I've been in that situation, you know, when someone goes, you did this, and you're like, I didn't, and they're like, well, I saw you do it, and you just because, like, what can you, there's no response to, but I saw you do it. Even if you know that you didn't do something, or you feel like you didn't do something, reality is something else, but there's no argument to, but I saw you do it. And the line in the film was, she's like, I don't know what to tell you. I didn't see anything. And he's like, oh, that we have a surveillance. We had a surveillance team with evidence that you did it. So what do you have to say to that? And I just, like, my entire, like, being just went, oh, no. Because I've, you know, haven't been in that specific situation. But, you know.
I just find it completely, like, dumbfounding. How could anybody?
It's insane. And that? Yeah, I hope to whatever gods might exist that I would be the person to be like, hang on a fucking minute here. But I think I also know that if the right conditions, if I was, like, you know, I was tired enough, if I was worn down enough, if I was stressed out enough, my brain might not make those connections. Like, so I don't want to let her off of any responsibility, because I feel like, whatever about the initial bit of it, but after a certain amount of time, your brain will click into gear and go, hang on a darn tootin' minute here. But I think I try never to be that person being like, I would never join a cult. You know, because we all decided that we could feel the energy of crystals at some point when we were 15 years old. And, you know, it's not quite the same, but, you know, wrong set of circumstances, wrong time. I do think that everyone is possibly susceptible to it in some form or another. So just hope I'm never put in that position.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm always kind of curious as whether there is, like, a certain type of person that is more susceptible to these kind of things, like cults. Whether there is, like, other sets of people that aren't.
From what I've read, and I, you know, that's obviously only a relatively limited amount in the grand scheme of things. From what I've read is that cults in particular tend to focus on people during when they're in a quite vulnerable time of their lives. So you can be a very intelligent, very pragmatic person, but if you're at a vulnerable point in your life where they can offer you something that you need, it doesn't matter how smart you are, they can get you. So it's not necessarily about how the type of person you are. I mean, sorry, that's not entirely true. I think if you are brought up with a deference to authority and you've never been in the position to understand that authority can be abused, then obviously, yeah, you'd probably be more susceptible to that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. I just don't think I like people enough to Come join this group of people.
I'm good. I just think there's too many multi-level marketing schemes in the world to be able to believe that there isn't one out there that might get me. Just one, you know. Like, there's been times when I've been really stressed and I've been broke and I've been worried about money, and you know, you see an ad that's like, you can make this much from home and you can control your own hours, and there's a bit of your brain that for just a second goes, oh god, yeah, maybe. And then your brain goes, ah, nope, that's an MLM, fuck off, that's a cult. But like, there's a tiny bit of my brain that goes, oh, but wouldn't it be lovely, would it be just easier if I did that?
Is Avon an MLM?
It is in the US much more than it is over here. So in the US it's an MLM, but over here, at least when I was a kid, as far as I'm aware, it wasn't a case of like you got money for recruiting people. You just sold Avon stuff and you got a commission, which is fine. That's normal. That's a relatively normal thing.
I was like, I just imagine my whole childhood would come crashing down if I found out Avon.
Oh, I had a lot of Avon products as a child.
Do, yeah.
Myself and my mum, we'd like sit down and look through the catalogue. Now, look, I actually could be wrong. If anyone's mother was an Avon rep in Ireland in the 1990s, if you please get in touch and let us know if you got any commission for recruiting in other Avon reps, that'd be great. But no, I don't think so.
Okay. Okay.
Fair enough. Possibly it's illegal in Ireland. One good thing we've done right.
Like, yeah.
We may have had the laundries, but at least we outlawed MLMs.
Although I know a few people that have definitely fallen into the traps of them.
Oh yeah, I get a couple of invites to go to certain, like, you know, product parties and stuff. And it's just, I'm just like, mute conversation.
That makes me think, like, is Tupperware? I'm like, all these kind of things. I'm like, is Anne Summers in it?
It sounds kind of, again, kind of like a little tiny bit. I don't know. Yeah, sex toy parties and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it actually turns out it's being headed by all these people in white robes and calling the head of them grandfather and stuff like that. God. Grandfather Avon.
I know. Yeah, we yeah. That, well, I mean, look, if Avon proves nothing, it's that we're all slightly susceptible. We had good skincare products at the time.
Our skin was glowing with that.
Beautiful new products. Yeah.
Okay, that was really good. Well, it wasn't really good.
No, so. Very depressing. But
you told it very good.
I did. Yeah. No, I can't. I just say though, the film Compliance is really excellent. It is worth a watch if it's something that you're able for. And there is, I haven't had a chance to track it down yet, there is a new documentary that's come out recently. It's available on Paramount Plus over here, which I don't have a subscription to, called Don't Pick Up the Phone, which is about the whole thing. So
interesting. Yeah, I definitely need to stick Compliance on my watch list. Just, you know, top of all disturbing films I need to. It was something I was saying to you before I came in. I went for a massage and the woman afterwards is like, make sure you go home and don't get straight back into work. Just relax. And I'm like, all I can think of is all of these fucked up films that I have to go home and watch for this weekend and like for work. And I'm just like, yeah, that's not really my bag.
Yeah, like life choices.
Yeah. And even because, you know, you've got to put your job description down on the on like the consent form.
Oh yeah.
Just to, you know, in case it's a really stressful job.
What did you put film critic?
I put film critic. And she was like, that's an interesting job. And I was like, don't question me on it. Please don't question me on it.
Very specifically horror. So. Yeah.
Okay, so.
What's your bummer?
My bummer is a big bummer. I am going to do the alleged true story. It hasn't been confirmed, but it's very similar. The alleged true story behind Megan is Missing. Oh no.
So I had only ever heard of Megan is Missing, and then you told me about it, and I looked up screenshots and I was like, nope, hard no, I am not watching that anytime soon. Read the plot summary on Wikipedia. I was like, all right, that's enough.
So Megan is Missing is one of my recent finds. It's been around for 12 years at this point, so 2011.
Yeah, I definitely heard about it as one of those like Running the Gauntlet type movies.
And it's just made a bit of a resurgence due to TikTok and teens finding this found footage horror film and being like, what is this? Is this real? What the fuck is happening? It's a psychological horror film. Oh God, yeah. These poor kids that found this film. Poor kids. And had no like they found this film and they didn't have any kind of background to it.
No context to it.
That's it. No context. Yeah.
Oh God, love them.
Bless them. Bless them. It is a very low budget independent film. And it centers around these two girls that go missing, hence the name. So the first girl goes missing and then her best friend tries to find her. And while she is doing her search, she goes missing herself. And it's very, 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 very fucked up. I would not recommend it to anybody who is of a sensitive nature at all. So I am doing Ward Weaver the Third, the alleged inspiration behind Megan is Missing.
Oh God! All right, go on.
Go on there.
I'm so nervous.
Oh God, you should be. In January of 2002, 12-year-old Ashley Pond disappeared on her way to the bus stop in her hometown of Oregon City. And 2 months later, her classmate Miranda Gaddis also completely disappeared without any sort of explanation. Both of the girls' disappearances went international and attracted huge media attention, even featuring on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. In August of the same year, both of the girls' remains were discovered on the property of one Ward Weaver III while he was being investigated for the rape of his own son's girlfriend. So, Ward Weaver III, despite his very grand name, was quite the opposite. He was born in 1963 in Humboldt County, California, to parents Trish and Ward Weaver Jr. When Ward number 3 was just 4 years old, his father left the family. And when his mother remarried several years later, it was to an abusive alcoholic named Bob Budrow. It was then that the family relocated to Portland, Oregon. Weaver's antisocial behavior was first noticed just before he became a teenager. His own sister, Tammy, admitted that Ward had physically and sexually abused another family member by the time he was 12 years old, as well as accusations of him constantly beating his brother, Robert. In the early 80s, one of Weaver's family members came forward to police and reported that Weaver had repeatedly raped and beat her. Whilst police did investigate these allegations, of course the police failed to do their fucking job because they decided not to pursue these charges because Weaver had joined the armed forces and was due to leave Portland.
So what, it didn't matter anymore?
No, apparently his crime was null and void because he was leaving the state.
I feel like the subtitle for this podcast should be like,
the police suck.
Yeah, movies, murder and mayhem, or how the police continually fail to do their jobs and bring killers to justice. A treatise.
Right. After graduating high school, Weaver did indeed join the US Navy Reserve, yet he was discharged after barely a year for heavy drinking and not performing his duties. But while he was in the reserve, he met his wife, Maria Stout, who was a native of the Philippines. After marrying, the couple moved back in with Weaver's mom and stepfather, and she soon became pregnant. So 5 months into her pregnancy, Weaver beat his wife and she was hospitalized, but unfortunately she refused to press charges. And in December of 1982, their first child, a boy called Francis, was born. However, it was later determined that Francis was not actually Ward's biological son.
Probably for the best.
On June 15th, 1986, Weaver attacked the teenage daughters of one of his friends with a concrete block in California, where himself and his wife had relocated. He was imprisoned for 3 years, and once he was released, himself and his wife Maria and their children relocated back to Oregon and opened a store, as you do. In 1993, Maria divorced Ward Weaver III, eventually having to get a restraining order against him. And then Weaver...
It took that long.
I know, right? Sorry,
I shouldn't say that. I know abusive relationships are complicated. Sorry. It is. You're just like, get out, girl. You're in danger. Like, no, move. Get away. Sorry.
And then, of course, he remarried, because these abusers always do, to a Christy Sloan, who he also beat with a cast iron skillet. And while he had been jailed for this, Christy did not testify against him, and their marriage continued for another 4 years.
Oh, God, love the pair of them.
I know. So just a side note, just a random side note while all this is going on, Ward Weaver II, his father, he was actually charged with the murder of a couple whose car had broken down back in California in 1981, and he was sentenced to death in 1984 for this crime. And he was also the suspect of a serial killer who had claimed as many as 24 victims.
So really, he's fucking genetic, like.
Seems.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So yeah, it really brings up this question of like nature versus nurture.
Yeah, like you do wonder in that situation then, was how aware was he of his father's activities? And like, was it literally like he was, you know, brought up in the family tradition, or was it genuinely like a completely separate thing? We're probably never going to know, but I'm curious.
Yeah, same. I'd love, you know, where they do like those imaging of the inside of like serial killers' heads.
Yeah.
I'd love to know that. I've been watching a lot of Criminal Minds recently, so I'm very, again, obviously, because I rewatch it every year.
Yeah. You love Criminal Minds.
So, yes. So, back to our third Ward Weaver. In 1997, Weaver began an affair with a woman from work, and after his second divorce, they moved into a rented property together. At this point, Weaver's 12-year-old daughter, Mallory, who he had with his first wife, Maria, she became best friends with Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis. All three went to middle school together, as well as they attended the same dance class. Now, in another case of the police being utter shitheads, in 2001, Ashley Pond reported to police that Ward Weaver had tried to rape her at his house. Yet the charges were not filed by the police, because why would they?
What the fuck?
Right?
I feel like, okay, again, 2001, this is not the fucking 60s. And like, I thought at least with kids, they were like, isn't that the whole thing? Of like, kids are always believed sometimes to the point of it being not a great thing.
I assume that because she was 12 and she...
They were like, you're a woman now, so you must be a liar.
Exactly. That was probably exactly it.
Have you had your first period? You're a liar.
Yeah, that was... Exactly. Sorry. It. So on the morning of January the 9th, 2002, Ashley Pond left her home in the nearby apartments to walk to a bus stop that was near her home, like literally around the corner from her house. Yet she never arrived at her destination. Everyone, friends and family, including her friend Miranda Gaddis, began to search for Ashley. Miranda even helped arrange a fundraiser with the dance class they were both members of to help the search of her friend, and that fundraiser was scheduled for like the 23rd of March. On March the 8th, 2002, Miranda had also disappeared. So both of these disappearances then got the attention of the FBI, who linked the two girls' disappearances as having been perpetrated by the same person. While I was writing this, I was almost going to be like, the same unsub, but then I realized that was just... Again, Criminal Minds coming through. And I was like, stop it, Graham. You're not Hotch. So while the search for both the girls were going on, Ward Weaver, meanwhile, had enlisted the help of his son to dig a hole in his back garden and cover it with concrete. He told his son it was to serve as the foundations of a hot tub he was hoping to install. Like, Criminal 101. Don't dig a fucking hole in your back garden and fill it with concrete.
Especially not while there's like an ongoing search for missing people.
Right. So due to one of Ashley Pond's relatives being a private investigator, she tipped off the FBI about Ward Weaver, and he became the prime suspect in the disappearance of both of these young girls.
So it was a relative of one of the victims, not the cops who had the victim report an attempted rape.
Yep. It was literally because one of Ashley Park's relatives was a private investigator.
I just... Yep. Oh, God. Oh, God.
You want to know a really, really fucked up thing? Apart from every other fucked up thing?
Every other fucked up thing? Yeah, go on. Sure, why not?
So, Ward Weaver was interviewed by KATU Television News, okay?
Of course he fucking was.
And the interview took place whilst Weaver was standing on that concrete slab professing his innocence.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. He was that much of a fucking... He had that much of the gall. The gall and the audacity.
And the gumption. Jesus Christ, that is something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a thing though, isn't it? With a lot of guys who, like, they just think, they think they're so smart.
Yeah.
Ugh, anyway.
Yeah. So on August 13th, 2002, Ward Weaver's son Francis reported to police that his own father had attempted to rape his 19-year-old girlfriend. And he also alluded to the fact that Weaver may have had something to do with the disappearance of Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis. Due to Weaver's arrest for the assault, police gained a warrant to search his property. Pond's stepmother, who had suspected Weaver all along, actually put up a sign next to the concrete slab in Weaver's garden that read, "Dig me up."
Good for her.
Yep. So once the FBI began to search his property, they discovered the remains of Miranda Gaddis inside an empty microwave box inside a storage shed behind the house. And on the 25th of August, Ashley Pond's remains were uncovered from beneath the concrete in the back garden where they'd been stored in a 55-gallon barrel.
Oh, not the barrel.
Yeah. So that kind of alludes to Megan is missing, spoiler alert,
yeah.
That bit. So in 2002, Governor John Kitzhaber launched an investigation as to why the initial report of Weaver's abuse of Ashley Pond was never properly filed.
Good.
I know, sorry. Right? Good for him.
That bit just never usually happens. So I'm glad someone was like, hey, hang on a second. Why? Yeah.
This all could have been prevented if the police had just done their fucking jobs properly. So in, where am I? So Weaver was charged with 6 counts of aggravated murder, two counts of abuse of a corpse in the second degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of attempted rape in the second degree, 1 count of attempted aggravated murder, 1 count of first degree attempted rape, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the second degree, and 2 counts of sexual abuse in the third degree. So in September of 2004, Ward Weaver III pled guilty to 2 of the charges and no contest to the rest. But because he took a plea bargain, he was exempt from the death penalty and instead was sentenced to 2 life sentences without parole.
I mean, look, I am not pro corporal punishment, so I will take life imprisonment. At least, yeah, it's always weird hearing the counts or like the charges, because I know they do them in a certain way to ensure like the best chance of a conviction, but it's, and you're just like, huh, why, huh, like illegal nonsense. But
so in a very chilling aftermath, Miranda Gaddis's younger sister Mariah visited Weaver in prison twice, so she could understand what happened and why he did what he did. Weaver confessed how he had killed the 2 girls with his own bare hands. And he also admitted that he had planned to murder Mariah next.
Oh, God.
So he was the worst of the worst human being.
Fucking terrible. Jesus Christ, God love her. I mean, I she probably needed it for her own closure. But like, and look, at least he gave her that. Because there's a lot of guys out there who wouldn't.
Yep.
I know that's a weird thing to say, but.
Yeah. So that is the possible true story behind Megan is missing.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there, huh?
There is. There's a lot. Very creepy that, yeah, I just, because I didn't know there was like a true story behind Megan is missing. And it creeped me out. But now knowing that there is a somewhat true story behind it, I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah. I mean, I can only hope that Megan is missing is much more extreme, because
it is.
Yeah.
Like, but, I mean, yeah, it's very extreme.
Yeah.
I really like it. I hate saying I like it because you shouldn't. I'm like, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I thought it was fun. No. No, it is weird to say you like these very extreme movies. Mm. It's like, you know, liking a lot of like Martyrs and stuff like that. Yeah. It's like is not necessarily the word, but like, and neither is enjoy. but they were good movies that you didn't not like. That makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, I appreciate them, I think is the correct. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think the clips and stuff and the synopsis that I've seen of Megan Is Missing is probably enough for me. I don't think I need anymore. I was just like, I just googling it there. And one of the stills is like this, the cover of a TikTok, and it's just like, I finished Megan Is Missing, and I really wish I hadn't even watched it. Like, yeah, no shit, bitch.
Yeah, I just because it's based on this internet generation where it's, you know, yeah, based around chat rooms and talking to people you don't know, which it's funny because our generation was the generation of like Omegle and Chat Roulette.
You're a little bit younger than me. Omegle and Chat Roulette was a little bit after my time. I was more like AIM, you know,
MSN chat room, yeah,
kind of person. Yahoo Groups.
Well, or MSN Messenger, that was the other one.
You know, MSN Messenger, AIM. Like I had, you know, it's the day of GeoCities when there was like a little link tree at the bottom and you had to like, there was no Googling. You found the one website and then they would link to all the other websites.
Yeah, so
chat lists when you just get like, you know, chat room, but basically via email. So yeah, Omegle was a little bit after my time.
So yeah, but I just feel like it's, the reason it's come around again is because there's still this kind of anonymity on the internet. You know, if there wasn't, Catfish wouldn't have been such a massive.
Oh my God, yeah. No, absolutely. And it's, you know, just because the like a chat room is, you know, slightly outdated, but you know, now it's a million, like, you know, people adding into your DMs or whatever in a creepy way.
Yeah. Megan Is Missing is like if Catfish, the documentary movie, was a horror film.
Oh God, yeah.
Which I actually thought it was when I first saw it.
It's just, yeah, it's I know, I can't even, like, it's unfair for me to say, it's just so upsetting, but because I haven't even seen the whole movie, but even from what I have seen, I'm like, no, it's too upsetting.
Yeah, I'd love to do a day where we just watch like all of my extreme horror recommendations.
I have a pretty high, like, I do actually have a pretty high gore threshold. But there's something about certain kinds of torture porn movies that really just, they just make my skin crawl. Look, that'll be a fun like Twitch stream. Just a camera on me being like, oh no, I can't, no, stop it.
What did you show me? It's so funny because like,
why?
A lot of the time I get thrown like extreme movies to review, which is grand. Like that's, you know, I'm enjoying this journey into the extreme, but it's so funny because like I'll be watching something on the laptop and Oscar will walk in and be like, what are you watching? And I'm just like flipping down the screen like, nothing, don't watch it. Oh my God, don't watch it. I was watching something like a while back and he kind of popped his head around. And he's like, are you watching gay porn? And I was like, no.
Nope, that's for work.
It's just extreme horror. And he's like, no, that's gay porn. And I was like, wait till it gets to the end. And then it like,
zoomed out and he was like, oh dear.
Yeah, he was like, oh dear God. So it was part of an anthology film and it was set in a, like a BDSM gay club and there was all these blokes doing something to a tied up bloke and then they went in for the fisting but the fist came out of his mouth and
oh no.
It was the best segment of the anthology, I'll give it that.
It does sound kind of, I mean, weirdly funny. You know, it's like, I don't know, like that bit where in like Ash versus the Evil Dead where Ash ends up wearing a corpse as a hat kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Get that going on. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway, so that is, I was just about to say, that's our bummer of the week, but we've ended on a fisting, so.
We've ended on a discussion of fisting, so that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, this has been,
Things that make you go,
Things that make you go,
I want to ask before we go, have you been watching The Last of Us?
I haven't. I haven't. I really haven't had the time. For various different reasons, so it's been a bit of a comfort food watch period for us, but I am planning on just downloading it all and having a lovely time watching it because I've heard it's great. We all love Pedro Pascal. I love the video games, so
he's my divorce clause. Oscar doesn't know it yet, but he's my divorce course. Although I think he's got some fair idea, because we were actually Valentine's Day. We were sitting having our like meal. I just cooked a really nice meal. And we had an argument about whether he was better looking now or back then. Oh. And I was like, how dare you? He is daddy. He's my new horror daddy.
He's your new horror daddy?
Yeah, he's overtaken Patrick Wilson.
Oh, it's just because of The Last of Us?
Yes.
Because he hasn't done, has he done much other horror?
No. He did, really? Actually, he did a vampire film, so I'm going to have to. And he was in Buffy.
He was in Buffy. It's the worst thing about The Mandalorian, which I do genuinely very much enjoy, is that fact that he is mostly wearing a helmet.
I know, but he's got like, such a sexy voice.
Okay. He does have a very sexy voice.
Yeah, and he's just, he's such a chaotic person, and I love that about him.
He is. I very much enjoy his chaos energy. he's like a sexy trickster god from Philly. All right, okay, so Pedro Pascal, official new horror daddy. That is the news, the non-bummer news that we have for you in this episode of or in this case
Pedro Pascal. Definitely something to make you go
Join us next month when I will get the title of the podcast correct.
I was just about to start recording, but we've got to do the whole like
the thing.
Find us on Twitter at what_scream. Not what is an underscore scream. And yeah, don't forget to review, subscribe, come back for more.
Yeah, slide into our DMs like a weird potential serial killer and let us know what you think. We would always appreciate it.